welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Cameron Barnett. Cameron Barnett is a poet living in Greenfield, where he enjoys going for long runs in Chenley Park and hanging out with his roommate's two cats, Goose and Lorna D. He is associate editor for Pittsburgh Poetry Review, and his recent work has been featured in Tri-Quarterly and Pittsburgh Poetry Houses. He works as the artist in residence at the Falk School in Oakland. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well.
Well, welcome to Prosody. We're excited to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Would you like to begin by reading some poems?
Yeah, sure. This first poem is actually from the first issue of Pittsburgh Poetry Review. So since I'm now reading for them, I figured I'd start with that poem. It's called Stepping Into Your Mouth for Komunyaka. The front door of anything is always a trap, and so I have pried back your cellar doors, the musk of mildew dank in the air like a breath held long for something special, and I am almost certain I'm stepping into your mouth. Tell me what to do with my shoes, which tooth to hang my coat on. Epiglottis lamp chain, a yank light from your throat. I am knocking over your furniture. I am not apologizing. We are all guilty of something, and I am holding a fistful of your cavities. Tell me what you love and what you regret. Your sofa's short arms and long spine call out to me. I might stay a while longer. I might pilfer your sock drawer, empty your bathroom cabinets, rearrange your spice rack, any little thing to move your tongue. In a small vase, you keep the seeds of the Vietnam tree that stopped that bullet, the one meant to shepherd you into that darkest cellar. I put one seed in my pocket and tell myself every adventure needs an amulet. I'm sure I will find my way out of this house eventually, but not tonight. I take another seed, place it in the palm of your hand, ask you to write me a poem with it. What did you lose in the war, and who was it meant for? How do most men find death at the end of a gun barrel, but you find poetry? I am full of more questions than you can swallow. Now the tops of the windows bleed sunlight above a curtain rod horizon, and I know it is only morning. Yusuf, it's going to be warm until November. I might stay a while longer. These next two are in my larger manuscript, but actually excerpted from a chapbook that I was doing in my MFA, which is called The Bones We Lose. And they actually take after Yusuf Komunyaka's Thorn Merchant project. So I did my own sort of version of those poems about a character called the Note Broker. So this first one is called The Note Broker. His eyes are the color of cracked crayons rubbed end to end. In the alleyway, he lays way down, thinner than a 9-cent dime. His hand catches the slick of a magazine, pulls it up hoping for sheet music. Instead, he reads about the pieces that were cut from the Shroud of Turin. His hands hold crumpled corners of pages, fingers dotted long ago with paper cuts from a love letter. A bone inside a bone is breaking. There are small memories at work between thumb and forefinger. He knows the more a thing is understood, the more it is destroyed. In the distance, a trumpet blares asthmatically, his blood crooning around each failed note. Beyond the brick wall, people are talking, the type who speak only from the neck, the type who don't know a song from an echo. But the words inside him are not these. The chip on his shoulder is made of sawdust. Their song is not his. Which is to say, every rib in his body is a tuning fork waiting to be struck. And the second one is called The Accomplice. None other than the Bishop of Blues, AKA Hank the Hot Stepper, godfather of brass and barbells, flexing that shark skin, double-breasted suit with matching trumpet case. It's no wonder he rolls into town on white wall tires with more pep than 76 trombones in the morning sun. Manhole covers rattle like snake tails and spit sewer steam on his black suede shoes. With nothing but a shrug and a swagger step, he brings out sinners in a septic city, shaking tempest hard, and for a time, people are weak-kneed, wailing like 10-foot tubas. When he enters the Omni, he casts a wily wink toward karma, orders an old-fashioned, and sips real smooth. Never mind her kiss clotting in his heart, a black spot sinking in like a splinter, or the Jankowski family's men high and tight on his neck where his close shave stops. The thick sheen of an axe handle flashes in his eyes. Could have seen it coming. He's at the coat check whistling Sweet Home Chicago, and no one says a word while the mob moves outside like a rugby scrum, backlit in scarlet, the hot stepper's teeth filling the cold cracks in cobblestone. A pale horse clip-clops the street, while inside, a high note hits the air, ringing like a syllable for revenge. This one is actually the title poem of my manuscript, The Drowning Boy's Guide to Water. Remember the strength of chlorine, the indoor pool, swim class clinging to the kickboard, then jumping from the ledge into the arms of the smiling white lady, only mostly sure she would catch you. Mom calling, Cameron, Cameron, to get you to look, then said, kick, kick. Remember, there's nothing a mother won't do for one still shot of your head above the water. It's important to always practice good form. Kick your legs. Remember Tortola, the sea like melted marbles and the sun at the equator, your brown skin browning. With a stretch of snorkel between your teeth, you jumped in and chased a sea turtle for the length of the tiny island's beach, the pressure in your ears right when you thought you could catch it, mom and dad sighing when you came back to the surface. Remember your worst fear is not being able to breathe. Most people who drown are brown, and 80% of people who drown are male. Don't forget to kick your legs. Don't forget middle school musicals, all the costumes and makeup, the white boys making jokes about blackface, the laughter gurgling in their necks, no one else like you to back you up. Sometimes you will swallow water. Remember, a throat is the size of a Skittle or a hole in a hoodie, and Trayvon's legs kicked hard against the night. Drowning isn't loud or splashy, it's silent, autonomic, neck tilt and terror. When you are drowning, feet become rocks. Hands push down water in vain, and the thump of blood is the only thing that can be heard. It is all supposedly painless. Always remember that. Always remember your first girlfriend's grandmother sneering at the sight of her white arms wrapped up in your hoodie, how you pretended it was painless, but you couldn't help but kick your legs, or how nobody will save you anymore when you yell, I can't breathe, so just kick your legs, or every sidewalk where a white girl sees you, pulls her phone up to her face and crosses the street like she's guarding something secret. Kick your legs. Remember that you have been a white girl's secret before. Kick your legs. When you are drowning, don't forget to practice good form. Float on the surface. Part the water with your lips. Only swallow as much as you can hold.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Cameron Barnett, reading from his manuscript, The Drowning Boy's Guide to Water. Cameron, there's so much I like about your work, particularly the imagery and the rhythms that you play with. I'd like to start with the first poem you read, Stepping Into Your Mouth. It plays with metaphor in a very interesting way. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. That poem was born of a summer workshop with some of my fellow MFA members, and there was a prompt about, like, what would you do if you could go to the home of any famous writer? Like, what would you do? What would you say to them? And I imagined taking that a step further and, like, entering the writer themselves. Yusuf Komunyakaa has been a poet that I've really admired, and I figured sort of like taking the idea of like stepping into his mouth as like a metaphor for stepping into his work and his writing as a place to inhabit like a home would be interesting. So then I started imagining like, you know, what if a tooth is a coat hanger and stuff like that. So it just kind of got wild from there.
So you imagine stepping into his mouth as you or as...
Yeah, as me,
like
sort of.
Like not necessarily embodying him, but living inside.
Yeah, like, you know, me as an aspiring writer stepping into, you know, his accomplished writerly mouth, I guess, so to speak, and saying, what's up?
Right. Know? That's really fascinating. Do you find that prompts help you write? Where do you get a lot of your inspiration or ideas from?
I think it's a mix. I mean, definitely growing up, as I, you know, leaned into writing, I was all about prompts. I love sort of the challenge of them. How could I work inside of a prompt? How can I work around it? But, you know, other times, such as The Drowning Boy's Guide to Water, the flow of that poem was totally an organic thing. So it comes in waves, but definitely when I'm in a sort of a communal workshop environment, I love working with prompts that other writers bring or that I bring as a challenge to the rest of the group.
That's cool. So speaking of the Drowning Boy's Guide to Water, the title poem, how do you envision that as the title poem for a manuscript? That's always tricky, picking a title poem, or, you know, this is the poem that's going to embody the work. So how do you imagine that working in that way?
Sure. That's, you know, sort of the big question of my manuscripts for me. This manuscript is very much about race, very much about identity, but not necessarily in the most constantly assertive way, but also in a sort of self-reflective questioning way. And so I chose The Drowning Boy's Guide to Water as the title for the book, or for the manuscript, I should say, because I wanted to evoke both a person who would be an unreliable sort of authority figure, like a person who's drowning, seemingly doesn't know much about water, but also on the flip side of that, to be drowning is a very intimate interaction with water, and who better to know that than someone who is drowning or has drowned. And for my book, water operates in a lot of avenues with race. Emmett Till features prominently in my manuscript, and so there's a lot of sort of tones I'm trying to hit with what water and race can sort of mean together.
Mm-hmm. You really like playing with metaphors.
Oh, I'm a metaphor junkie. Probably too much sometimes, but.
Do you revise for metaphor, or does it just happen? They're hard. I mean, let's be honest. Metaphors are not necessarily easy to come by.
Oh, they're not natural. Work. Yeah, I've been blessed to have a few just sort of organically pop in my head, but definitely, I have to be honest and say that I go back a lot of times and I find something where I was like, oh, you know, I could really, you know, push this point here or there. Revision's never been my thing, but it works out really well for me when I sit down and do it.
Do you look for metaphor when you're reading as a reader, like in other people's work?
Yeah, I would say so. I'm drawn to metaphor. I'm drawn to you know, rich, deep imagery. I think that's why I admire Komunyakis so much. Which isn't to say that there aren't other influences in my work, but you know, if I can push a really good image into a kind of crazy space and create something new, that's always my first impulse.
That's cool. Can you read us some more poems?
Sure. Speaking of Emmett Till, this next poem is one of the two main poems in my manuscript dealing specifically with him. This is the shorter of the two. It's called Emmett Till Haunts the Library in Money, Mississippi. What I can't let you know is that death, too, is a snore. A sooty shelf of unmoving paper with some gas bag lady at the front desk. If you knew, there'd be too many questions how I sneak past heaven's gate some days to nap against the silent stacks, feel the blood in my head drip into the young adult fiction. Mammy always preached good posture, so I sit straight at least. When I was black, I grew used to the shuffle of visibility, to the move boy and the 1,000-yard stare over my head. Being ghost isn't all new or scary. No one to ask me what came out of my lips 60 years ago. I might as well be ink on closed pages, lost somewhere in the archives. You can't judge a book by its facts or flaps or back cover, but a black boy is the title and the illustration staring you in the face, asking to be seen or sampled, but not smothered between the other black boys, forgotten, dog-eared, and ditched. I don't love death, but I don't mind reading the periodicals for faces like mine, putting names to the ones I'll welcome through the gate soon. This next one, Between Skin. Suppose I say the word autumn and write satchel on a small blank note card, lick it closed in an envelope and mail it to you, so as you open it, standing alone in your cold kitchen, you recall crimson leaves crunching under our feet, the smell of the steep city trail, how we split clammy palms long enough for a love note to slip between the red patch flap of your bag, the corners of your grin pinned back with hesitation, our shoes kicking up the dirt. Or would you remember one evening that winter, overheated pots, your mother's steady stirring, bag in hand, the draw of your wrist unzipping, my notes pouring onto the table, the pinch of sleeve and skin in the zipper teeth, your mother's sparrow eye catching you flush-faced, the sigh and swift spurn of her snatching the red leather. I know I am hard to remember sometimes, especially when the morning finds you only mostly clothed, blushing by the sink with your coffee and a simple card reading satchel. Just think of it as a missed kiss, and that sting at the wrist, the tug between skin and bone, is the way I remember you, too. This next poem is actually one of my newest poems. I was really inspired by Simone Manuel's, her gold medal at the Olympics in swimming, and again, with water and blackness sort of weaving through my manuscript, this is one of those things that just kind of came to me. So this poem is called Muriatic. It's 1994, and I'm focused on the kickboard, toes lipping over pool's edge, anticipating the cool Anaheim water beneath, a carefully learned leaning of my body toward the swim instructor, her arms open, this white woman's embrace the first in a long line that I'll learn to trust and fear at the same time. But today it's 2016, and Flint, Michigan is boiling the metal in its water futilely, a bubbling brown, plastic bottles stacked forklift high, children stacking up in hospital weight rooms, sick with this water they were given against their will, like it's 1964 in St. Augustine, Florida, and rabbis and blacks are swimming in the Monson Motor Lodge pool while the manager cups a jug of muriatic acid, clear and colorless, dumps it into the water he skirts around, and the sheriff's men refuse to touch it while they pull bodies out against their will, like it's just another day. But today, it's 1936, and white men guard the pool in Pittsburgh's Highland Park, where black boys come up and ask, "Why can't we swim?" And the white men's boots and clubs answer them for decades and decades. And today, it's 2006, and the fountain in my high school arcs lukewarm water, cresting like the arch in my bent back. And just below to the side, I see a rectangle of old caulk, ghost of a fountain coming from the wall. And my back aches like it's 1950, and my grandfather is thirsty. So he steps into the long line, bows his head beneath the colored's only sign, lips pursed to the slow trickle, though the fountain is cleaner and stronger for whites only. But he doesn't dare meddle with their water today, in 1973, when the pool at Kennywood closes for good, and some will blame integration, and some will blame maintenance problems, and some will only know the parking lot paved over, or the splash of the Pittsburgh plunge as it dunks into new waters, spraying high in the air like it's 2005 in New Orleans, and Katrina's waters are either sink or swim, and the government chooses sink, and far too many whites say, "Why don't they just swim?" And far too many blacks don't have a choice at all, and hot days go by without help, like it's 1963 and the hoses are on us, and it's 1954 and Emmett Till can't breathe, and it's every year since then that black people have known the sting of the water and kept back, kept out, kept waiting for clean waters, safe waters, until finally it's 2016 and it's a dead heat in Rio, and Simone Manuel's hand hits the wall, and a gasp hits her face and wide smile disbelief when a black girl wins a gold medal in the water. And wide-smiled black girls slip on swimsuits, and little brown and black kids peek their toes over swimming pools' edges, knowing today, for the first time, the water can be our home, too.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Cameron Barnett, reading from his manuscript, The Drowning Boy's Guide to Water. I really like that, the water. Well, there's a lot going on. But I wonder, what are the particular challenges or even maybe freeing episodes of writing about race?
What do you mean?
Like, is it difficult? Do you feel limited? Do you feel like I can say this, I can't say that? What if people read this? Do you find yourself editing a lot? I mean, personally, if I try to write about race, all those things start coming up and then I get frozen.
Yeah.
So I wonder if what sort of things happen to you when you are exploring this?
Definitely. For a long time, I actually struggled with whether or not I even had sort of the right to write about blackness. My own personal background isn't as in line with what I imagine most people think a typical black experience in America is. My background's a little bit more privileged. And so it was a huge hurdle for me to leap over to say, well, I have my own black experiences by virtue of the fact that I am a black person, and you know those count just as much as any other narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely do struggle with who is the audience of my poems. Am I talking down to people? Am I coming off as too angry? Am I coming off as too soft? I mean, I think my concerns about race are very close to most poets' concerns about their poems in general, but definitely I do worry about, oh, is this a poem where I should use the N-word? Or is this a poem where I should say blacks or whites? Should I say African-American or something like that? There are a lot of tone questions, and my solution is just to say, honestly, how do I feel right now? And put that word in there.
So for the Muriatic poem, did you do a lot of research then? Finding those different sort of historical time points that related back to water?
Definitely. And it was a little bit of sort of serendipity and research. The same time that she won her gold medal, I came across an article on my Facebook that was talking about a forgotten moment in the civil rights movement where at the Monson Motor Lodge, the owner took muriatic acid, which is hydrochloric acid, and dumped it in a pool that a bunch of black and Jewish protesters were occupying to talk about desegregation of pools. And then remembered that Pittsburgh has a fraught history with that as well. And then I was like, well, I'm talking about blackness and water in my manuscript too. And so I just looked up, I thought of a bunch of examples that I knew from my own lived experience, from my family's experience, and from, you know, the nation's experience, and tied it all together in this rambling sort of point, you know, that black people in water have always had some challenges.
So do you feel in some ways perhaps your poems are a witness to something, or you don't think about that?
You know, I'd never considered that until you asked me right now. And I think they're definitely witness to things. There are poems in this manuscript about, you know, a lot of the recent police shootings that have gone on in the country.
And that's hard stuff to write about.
It is.
You know, just you don't really know where to position yourself as a speaker in a poem.
Mm-hmm.
What vantage point?
Yeah, it's definitely, there's a lot of emotional labor that goes into writing about, you know, Michael Brown, and which isn't to say there isn't emotional labor writing about Emmett Till either, but sort of the historical distance between then and now gets cut short when you think about Michael Brown and everyone else who's come after him. There's a poem at the end of my manuscript that has the names of several victims of police shootings listed in it, and I keep revising it because things keep happening. So,
right, just speaking of being a witness, list poem that's
exactly.
Pages and pages long,
which is tragic, but
right.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you before you read some more poems, what made you attracted to sort of water as an overarching theme or something that you can continue to play with throughout a larger body of work?
I think the fact that it's a natural earth element, and speaking of metaphor, that as much as water, I guess, is a very common thing, it's commonality to all of us. The fact that it's so much of our bodies, that it's everywhere, et cetera, seemed so apt for a discussion about race to me.
That's
that interesting. You can't escape it. It's everywhere. It's ingrained in who we are.
Yeah, it's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that race almost isn't sometimes. And we make it more necessary than it needs to be, I think. Can you read some more poems?
Sure. This poem is called When the Mute Swans Return. If you ask me, every spring should be spent on the Seneca. The casual swirl of wet fingers in the hard yawn of March, knuckling your way through the cloudy slough. your tussled likeness tonguing the surface, the shape of you clapping in on itself, everything slipping away in ripples. What else would happen pulling at water? When the mute swans return, a huff of leaves escapes the nearby tree. The fledgling wind refuses the home of your lungs. Only the Finger Lakes catch its breath, a hiccup. Sometimes the spring lakes feign themselves as clouds. The mute swans, to fly, pull at the water. This poem is in response to a poet friend of mine and a piece she wrote, Kim Grabowski, Kim Strayer. She just got married. So this poem is called Skin Theory. A crookedness laid bare around me. I want to find where the water breaks through. A finger pointed to all the wrong places. This is the first discovery. Consider the weight of hypothesis evaporated. And where have all the alchemists gone? An idea transmitted through air. I can't recall when it was I asked for your thoughts on a rare disease. The report, itchy cuticles. The evidence, cold flesh in a bottle. A Bunsen burner set low. Sweat as approximate calculation. Then came the shedding, a brief lull of light lipped into the eyes, a slow gripping, the word vessel scrawled somewhere. Here are your methods, how to translate them, how the throat becomes a tin can telephone stretched from space to space. I called you with the intent of silence. So much has been broken on the surface. Watch the meniscus drown. Watch the leather learn where to buckle and breathe. I want you to believe, to say the word proof with me. Yes, this is a fragile thing. So much can change, never just black and white layers. In the end, all I can give you is some small clasp of skin, the wrinkled space our chemistry has left behind. This next poem is another short guy that I like to read. I like to play around with word magnets on the refrigerator, and this poem was born of that. It's called How to Heal a Boy's Fever. Let him dream peace is a blue ship beneath the sea where prisoners linger willingly, swimming warm water cycles with one arm. Do not blush or say, clouds are almost as blue. He is not yet a man like you. Some things must be slow for his smile to remember itself, or quickly broken into sweat. If he comes to you, surrounded by an ocean of sleep, let him sail it, star-like and liquid-voiced, crying as if to explore dark skies. Listen when your son asks you, Father, what makes time so long? And why doesn't the sun have two moons, but always wants more shadows?
The poetry of Cameron Barnett. Thank you so much for being here, Cameron.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.